One of the good things about Warhol is that he always sold out. So it wasn't anything particularly new or surprising or what have you. What's fascinating is how he sells out, but it's still art. And he still is considered the premier painter of the later quarter, at least, of the 20th century. We're all familiar with this work, which always surprises us when we walk up the grand staircase in this museum, what turns out to be a late work by Warhol. Again, he did not intend it to be a late work. It unfortunately was, though. And it's part of the series he does where he's wearing what he called a fright wig. And it was a series that was commissioned by Anthony Dauphay Gallery in London for an exhibition that Anthony Dauphay wanted to have of Warhol's portraits, and left it really open to him how he wanted to create his self-portraits. And Warhol came up with this idea of the fright wig, and there are kind of variations on this, as we'll see when we get to it. But this is an image that we're very familiar with, and in some ways it seems rather removed from the pop images and the sort of sensibility that we think of with pop art, particularly a kind of impersonal character, as this almost death head is staring at us. Warhol, throughout his life, like any number of artists, continually portrayed himself, whether it was on canvas, silk screening, or whether it was film, as well as a variety of other forms that he might have turned to photography. I was thinking in particular. This is a self-portrait on the left that he creates when he's a student, just starting out at Carnegie Institute of Technology in Pittsburgh, painted around 1945. He's about 16, 17 probably years old at the time. So and he had done some self-portraits as a child as well. So it really spans his whole career. And he ends up doing probably as many, if not more, than any other artist of significance in terms of self-portraiture. We think of Rembrandt and Van Gogh, especially as focusing on portraiture or it being a major part of their work. Warhol probably created, I don't know what the numbers actually are, but probably created certainly more than Van Gogh and probably more portraits than Rembrandt as well. So it is a self-portrait. It's a major aspect of his career. And for somebody who always claimed he wanted to be a machine and that there was, nothing beyond the surface of his paintings, that he himself was of virtually no interest whatsoever, it's sort of a surprise that he would continually essay his own features. The title, Mirror Images, that I'm using is taken from a quotation he himself responded to, because he was often referred to as a mirror of society, as someone who was really simply reflecting back what was out there. It's also, I'll be your mirror, is a phrase, the opening and both the closing of a Lou Reed song written for the Velvet Underground in 1966 that says, I'll be your mirror, reflect what you are, I'll be your mirror. So again, this idea of him being a kind of reflection and distancing himself. We'll see if that's true or not so true. On the left is a modified passport. He traveled abroad in 1956, actually, a worldwide tour with a friend of his. And this was one of the extra passport pictures he had. And he was already going bald at this point, so he adds hair to himself. And he was never happy about his nose. He was never happy about his features, and so he does a little bit of self-cosmetic work in this image, is how he would like to look with a sharper, narrower nose and much more hair. I bring in a late image, one of the camouflage fright wig paintings, just to once again indicate from beginning to end of career, essentially, he's camouflaging himself. For all his saying, it's just a surface, it's just a mirror, it's something that's changing. He's presenting himself in different ways, different roles, different looks, different, in a sense, readings that are open to us as viewers. in the very early 60s, when he first emerges as a pop art, arguably the most significant pop artist, he really focuses on portraiture, and particularly celebrity portraiture. Immediately after Marilyn Monroe dies in August of 1962, he begins that series of works and will do, you know, at least 25 paintings, about 25 paintings by the end of 62, and then more throughout his career. Even before that, he had turned to Elvis Presley as a subject matter. He was also in 62, 63, doing images of Elizabeth Taylor, lots of images of Elizabeth Taylor, Natalie Wood, other stars and starlets, Troy Donahue, who's forgotten today, was really the first celebrity picture Warhol did in 1962. And using this, what becomes really identified with him, although he really uses it only this way in the first couple of years of the 60s, this repeated identical image, which is not quite identical after all because of the way he screened it, the way he's colored it, and so forth. But this notion of, in particular with celebrities, their ubiquity within our culture through reproduction, that we know them through their reproductions and their films, which is also a form of reproduction, of course. And there's been a lot of discussion whether the way that Warhol has constructed this and presented it, it is emphasizing the presence of these celebrities, or it's kind of dulling it. It's that they become so familiar over time that a celebrity loses their celebrity-ness eventually and are forgotten over time, unlike a hero, because of great deeds that have been done will be remembered longer. Marilyn, in particular, is the image that captures people's imaginations, I think. And again, it's been an image that resonates today very much with people, whether they think it's Lady Gaga, or if they're a little bit older and think it's Madonna, or if they even know it's Marilyn Monroe. It's all the same person, basically. It's all that same celebrity type that people are responding to and recognize. One of the, I think, most impressive and also one that has a sense of tremendous presence is the gold Marilyn, which this is a work on the left, that on the right, that is about close to 6 feet in height. For several years recently, it was used by the Museum of Modern Art, where it's housed, as their membership card. That is, their membership card had this gold card, essentially, it became, with Marilyn's image on it, as the way that members would get into the museum. But it's singling out that image, and it does show you, when you isolate something from this field of the celebrity being in our face all the time, that we do look at it differently and we do focus on it. And the kind of disembodied quality, the floating head, and it has almost a religious aspect. And I think, given that people became familiar with Warhol's religious bent after he died, it wasn't something people talked about or knew about during his lifetime, this work has been seen even more in a kind of religious sensibility, like an icon. It certainly is an icon, though, in a sense like a religious icon, in that it really becomes our image of Marilyn Monroe. It becomes what many people, if not most people, think about when they think about Marilyn Monroe, and that's why it's reproduced all the time. It becomes the thing that it's representing, like an icon does. Whoops, sorry. This is a 17th century Dutch icon, a Theotokos, that is the Greek word for Mary or Virgin, referring to the Madonna. Warhol was brought up in a fairly strict religious environment that was part Byzantine-oriented, part Catholicism, and saw icons in his churches, was very familiar with them. And there's no doubt, I think, that he had that in mind, with this heavenly field surrounding Marilyn Monroe more than an aura. It's really more celestial, heavenly, than it is even kind of like an auric quality to it. In 1963, after right at the end of 63 and into early 64, after he'd been doing these celebrity portraits for a while, a collector, a woman named Florence Baron, who was collecting Warhol's works, commissioned him to create his own self-portrait. He hadn't done one for a while, and certainly not in the new pop style, working with silk screen and working with acrylics and working with photographs, photographic reproductions. And so he, under this commission, created initially this work based upon photographs he had had made in a photo booth, one of the inexpensive photo booths where you go in and pull the curtains, make all sorts of silly faces and so forth. These were considered not only common, but certainly in New York City, sort of disreputable. They were in the bus station and around Times Square and other what were very seedy places at the time. And to use that was sort of a very low way of working. But he had used a photo booth images for a layout he did for Harper's Bazaar earlier in 63. So it was sort of on his mind. And he, when he was received this commission, he went to such a booth wearing the sunglasses and looks like a trench coat and so forth, and striking these various poses, and then having the photographs sent to a silk screening place that could photomechanically transfer it to the silk screen, and then they could be printed on grounds that had already been painted, the blue grounds that he had painted on the canvas. He begins receiving then a number of commissions, right around the same time. Ethel and Robert Scull, who also were early collectors of pop art. Many of you are familiar with the John Chamberlain Scull's Angel, that a sculpture that's in the collection here. That is a work that relates to Robert Scull, who owned a fleet of taxicabs. And they, early on, not only supported but collected pop art. And this was Warhol's, this portrait of Ethel Scull, was Warhol's first non-celebrity image. Even he was a celebrity when he did himself, because he had been quite well known in the 50s as a illustrator, as a graphic designer. But this is the first time he had a non-celebrity who he essentially aims to turn into a celebrity. And it's one of the things that made him a successful portraitist in the 70s, is that he conveyed this look of celebrityness that he had established doing Elvis, doing Liz Taylor, doing Marilyn Monroe, and brought that to real people who were not celebrities, but were maybe socialites, or in some cases they were leaders and so forth, but just collectors, for example, who could pay for him to work on it. She recounted, Ethel Scull recounted, how she went to Warhol's studio dressed very nicely. She had said she had a Yves Saint Laurent outfit on. Her hair was made up. She looked perfect. And she fully expected that they would trot over to Richard Avedon's studio, and he would photograph her, and then Warhol would work from that photograph. How she got that idea, I don't know. They went to East 52nd Street to a photo booth, much to her horror. And while she was in there, Warhol would poke her, grab her, and sort of direct her into a variety of poses. And they took a lot of pictures. He pumped a lot of quarters into the machine. Of course, she was paying for it all. Then he would, and this became fairly typical of his way of working with clients, he would then select out of literally hundreds of images, some said as many as 300 for this work. He selected 25 that he wanted to have transferred to silkscreen for his use. But he would also, with her and her husband, really talk about the ones he had selected and see if they agreed with it. In other words, He was open to that kind of collaboration, we might call it, that we think of in his later work. Again, it's part of his early work as well. And I think it comes out of his graphic design background, working with art directors, working with teams, working with clients, and so forth, that letting them be involved. And ultimately, I think the Skulls actually made the final selection of how they wanted it to be arranged, although Warhol was certainly art directing them along the way. It's a really wonderful image, quite large, each of the panels about 20 inches high. And it in some ways really anticipates postmodernism, so-called postmodernism of the 70s and afterwards, in the sense that one of the things that was stressed by postmodernism, the sense of relativism that exists in the world, and the fact that even people have multi-dimensions to them, that people have different roles during the course of the day. You're a daughter, a sister, a student, a nurse, whatever it might be. Just at different points, you're doing different things. And in a way, Warhol kind of brings that forward, that it's not just a typical portrait of somebody, but it's showing facets of someone, even if they're being tickled and punched, as it were, by Warhol outside the view of the window. This is a photograph of the, I just brought it in for context, there's a James Rosenquist pop painting on their wall. These are the Skulls at dinner. I have a feeling they really, the boys didn't wear coats and ties at dinner, but it's a very intriguing photograph. And the Skulls were part of a kind of new wave of collectors who made their money doing things like owning taxi cabs and so forth, and were kind of looked down upon old money, and were thought of as very nouveau riche. It's hard to see, but they have plastic seat covers on their chairs, which was, quite a thing in the 60s. And this isn't too often known, but when Warhol created the portrait of Ethel Skull, originally there were 35 images, not 36. And you see an earlier photograph of it on the left-hand side with Ethel Skull sort of fitted neatly into one of the panels that's behind her. But in 1968, for whatever reason, another panel from the original shot and work was added to it. And it's always configured this way now. But originally, it was more of a square format with the 35, not the 36 images. We were talking about Warhol's Brillo boxes last time, and the opening, and then the kind of question about, or is it art, or what's the difference between a Brillo box, or what looks like a Brillo box in a gallery and in a Albertson's loading dock area, say. After the opening of that show, people apparently went back to the factory, Warhol's studio, and pictures were taken, and that's what these two photographs are from. I brought them in because in both of these images, one showing on the left, Tom Wesselman, Roy Lichtenstein, James Rosenquist, Warhol, and Klaus Oldenburg, core group of the pop artists, the other showing Warhol and Robert Indiana in the same studio, a different part of it. But behind them in both, you see these images from his series called Most Wanted Men. And I brought that in because this isn't too often discussed, although it has been more in recent years. This turned out to be quite a controversial commission for Warhol. He was commissioned by Philip Johnson, the architect who, among other things, designed the Carter up the street. Johnson was had designed, and was in charge of things that were going to go in the New York State Pavilion for the World's Fair being held in New York in 1964. And he commissioned 10 artists, about half of them were pop artists, to create works that were going to go on the outside of one of the buildings, a circular building where it was going to have a 360-degree screen inside showing all about New York State, how wonderful it was, and so forth. So this the commissions were going to go on the outside of the building. This is the building. This is also part of the pavilion. It was a very odd pavilion with these huge towers and kind of canopy around. This is Robert Indiana. He had already made a film with Warhol earlier called Eat, and he uses a kind of reference to that. This is hard to see. It's actually here better. This is the